the Spot Track Podcast, talking sports contracts, the salary cap, and business of sports.
Welcome to another edition of the Spot Track Podcast. My name is Mike Trinetti. It is Monday, April 15th. Masters weekend is done. The NBA regular season is done. And the NFL has finally quieted down. Knock on wood, right? We've kind of been back and forth with a few iterations of the NFL offseason, which is really just exactly 1 month now in the books, but it feels like it's been three. We're going to talk Masters. We're going to talk NBA. I'm going to start with a little football here. We're going to bring in Scott Allen in a few minutes to dive into some of the numbers, the facts and figures attached to some of these other sports that we don't get to, generally speaking, on the Spot Track Podcast. Speaking of the NFL, quiet weekend. Good news for most. The Rashee Rice stuff is percolating. I have an idea of kind of where this is headed from an NFL standpoint, but this is a scenario that we've seen play out different ways for different people. Let's put it that way. And for different organizations. It's a non-guaranteed contract. That's what we'll say up front with that. There's limited dead cap on a rookie contract of his earth. So suspensions won't be gigantic in terms of finances lost, assuming there's going to be some sort of suspension. There may not. But if it has to get to a point where he has to get removed from a roster, I'm not sure we're there, even close to there yet. No guaranteed money to deal with in terms of what the Chiefs have on their end. Brandon Ayuk, speaking of wide receivers, may have requested a trade, may have not requested a trade. He's been a name we've been talking about for trades for about 4 months now. The Bills are in, the Jags are in, the Indianapolis Colts are in. Let's just say that out loud. There's teams that are definitely in on this player. Whether or not they want to pay him $100 million, which is what his current market value on SpotTrack is, 4 for $100, almost exactly on the dot, remains to be seen. That's certainly part of any trade conversation that San Francisco wants to have here, because it will, let's just say, it will be in the way. It'll be a distraction, a deterrence to what they can receive on the back end to get him out the door if they cannot reach a contract extension. Here's what I think happens with a couple of wide receivers here, because we've been through about 15 of them. And I would say half of those get extended over the next 3 months of this summer. T. Higgins is not going to be one of them. And he's also not going to be one of those players that's traded over the next 3 months of this summer. July 15th is the extension deadline. I was pretty confident when this franchise tag was passed out, even before that, when we were kind of projecting some things, that the Bengals want T. Higgins on the franchise tag in 2024. It is the best scenario for them with Burrow's contract, with Ja'Marr Chase still cheap this year, not cheap next year. They want to stagger things properly. This is the best way for them to do it. T. Higgins makes a good coin for 2024. They probably don't double tag him, as they didn't double tag Jesse Bates. He walks into free agency and finds himself $100 million. That's probably where this goes over the course of the next 11 months. I think it's a very similar conversation for Brandon Ayuk. It's fun to float him with trades. This is a good team for him. Maybe not the best team for him. You know, I think he aspires to be a true number one and sort of put his money where his mouth is. I don't think he's going to get there. And when none of these teams caves on a second round pick plus $100 million, 60 of that, which is fully guaranteed, San Francisco is going to keep him, and they're not going to extend him at that number because they have McCaffrey and Debo and Kittle and Trent Williams and et cetera, et cetera. And of course, Brock Purdy this time next year, most likely. So they're not going to go that route. What they are going to do is keep him on that fifth-year option, just over $14 million, fully guaranteed. Let him play it out. Maybe they franchise tag him. And then we talk about a tag and trade scenario that we've seen now twice this offseason already, and more each offseason as we get going. Or he just simply walks and they deal with a compensatory draft pick and we go from there. Something San Francisco has been kind of one of the better teams at doing. You know, they've been good at turnover. They've been good at keeping the core. They've been balanced, and they're obviously playing on house money with the Brock Purdy situation. So we'll see where things head over the next couple of weeks. I am not going to play the "he unfollowed us on social media" game. I'm not biting. I don't think San Francisco wants to trade him at this point, just as I didn't believe the Bills actually wanted to trade Stephon Diggs at this point. But offers change, and Houston made a good offer, and maybe Jacksonville or Indy comes in swinging hard for Ayuk. knowing that they have already been aggressive. And by the way, Tennessee, very much in this conversation as well. You put him next to a veteran on DeAndre Hopkins, and we'll see what happens with Treylon Burks. But this is there are some teams that have been gas pedaled down that appear to still be gas pedaled down. That's why I'm naming these teams. And Buffalo is just a team that has a need, most likely does it via the draft. So I'm not drinking the Kool-Aid on Brandon Ayuk just yet. I've never drank the Kool-Aid on T. Higgins. And a couple of quick running back notes, and we'll get to some master stuff. Raheem Mostert, kind of under the radar, restructured his contract. An actual renegotiation. It's basically like a 1-for-4-year extension, giving him a contract in 2025, even though really all it did is guarantee 2024 at about $3.7 million. Doesn't matter. All right, this is a team flush with weapons. They could have easily moved on from this player. They could have been in the Derrick Henry conversation. They could have been in a lot of these running backs. All right, we had about a dozen starting running backs hit the open market here. They didn't. They're sticking with this guy. They're sticking with A-Chain, and they're sticking with Mostert. And this was a cap neutral restructure. So this was really about keeping him under term, guaranteeing him early money this year, and getting him under term for 2025, which is saying something about a 30-something running back. He is worth a damn to this team, that's for sure. And that's one of those deals that was not salary cap oriented. It was cash oriented for his own purposes, not for Miami's purposes. That's a good sign for a team that clearly likes who they are right now, even though I don't think they're deep enough. And we have yet to see the Tua, Jalen Waddle contract stuff come to fruition. So there's some rocks to uncover, rocks to turn over here on this Miami offense, but good sign for sure there. And then Nick Chubb recovering from that nasty injury in Cleveland last year, which kind of derailed Cleveland's season, even though they certainly held the fort up, thanks to Joe Flacco. Haven't yet seen the full terms on this restructure. My guess is it shaved about $7 million of cap from what we're hearing, which means maybe a slight little signing bonus, but probably mostly base salary just cut right off, turned into incentives, not likely to hit the cap. And if he's healthy, and Nick Chubb, maybe he makes half of those back, which is usually the going rate for these kind of moves. But he wasn't going to stick at a $15 million cap charge. So he was a bubble player for that reason alone. And then certainly you factor in the injury, and it was going to be a bit of an issue here. So Cleveland got the job done. It's win-win. They get to keep this guy. Hopefully he gets back to 80% of Nick Chubb. Hopefully he gets to 80% of those incentives. And he's a $12 million running back again for at least one more season, with maybe some sort of Derrick Henry type extension next March. We'll see. But never really a clear path to them giving up on Nick Chubb. It was just simply, let's figure out some things the first month of free agency, and then we'll deal with a simple renegotiation as you rehab that works better for our cap, et cetera, et cetera. One more Cleveland Browns factoid, fun fact, whatever you want to say here on a Monday morning. Deshaun Watson's $63 million cap figure still stands. And I know there's been a lot of talk about that on the Twitter sphere, et cetera, et cetera. It's high. It's crazy. It's doable. Cleveland's already done most of their dirty work this offseason, including additions and extensions and trades and certainly cap conversions and things like that. What this says to me isn't Deshaun Watson's contract is the worst contract in the history of football. It might be. I don't think it is. I thought he played pretty damn well last year until he got injured. So I'm kind of on in his corner right now. And by the way, so are they probably, because it's not like they took any opportunity to really replace him at any point in time, even though I know there's a lot of rumors out there. Yeah, the contract is gaudy, all right? But $46 million guaranteed this year and next year, and then we'll talk about it after that. There's a lot worse out there. Check out the cash rankings on SpotTrack.com. You'll have a fun little rabbit hole to go down. It's a bad contract. It was a terrible trade. Everything about it, from a compensation standpoint, was bad. But the point to be made here is that they have not touched that $63 million. And when that doesn't happen, okay, there are various reasons that teams do not convert gigantic base salaries. Number one is they have figured out a plan to simply do eight other maneuvers in order to not have to do this one. That is what Cleveland has done to some degree with some cap casualties, with a bunch of cap conversions, with some trades, yada, yada. The fact that it was this player, though, right, that they didn't want to touch this player's contract is telling. All right. Because, yeah, the more dead cap they push down, the harder it's going to be to extend him in 2 years and certainly to move on from him in 2 years once a few of these void years have to accelerate in 2027 and things could get very, very ugly. So they are preserving their future finances at least for a moment. We could wake up Tuesday morning and that $63 million cap hit could be dropped down into the 30s pretty easily, right? It's just simple math. But if they don't, if they run 2024 out with him at that number, it might be good business and it might be really good insurance, right? It's good business if he ends up working out and needs an extension, and this just made that easier because it's less prorated bonus that has to get moved into the new contract. And if it doesn't work out, then it's extremely good insurance because now they've mitigated, limited, minimized to some degree the dead cap hit they're going to have to take to move on from this player when a trade is completely implausible and they simply just have to let the contract void. So something to make note of. I'm in his corner right now. I think that with the right team, and I think this coaching staff specifically, there's some promise here for him to at least come back to above average form. I don't think he's going to be a top five player, right? That slam dunk first ballot Pro Bowler that we saw in Houston for at least a cup of coffee. But we're getting there. And there's certainly a lot of weapons that they've run back that makes me think Cleveland certainly likes themselves about as much as I think Miami likes themselves right now, which is always a good thing as we head towards off-season workouts this week. All right, let's talk golf and NBA with Scott Allen. Scott, welcome to the show. It's been a minute. We did some chatting offline here. Certainly a big sports weekend, and I guess the NBA stuff kind of gets cloudy with all this Masters. And I mean, if you follow NASCAR, if you're following baseball at all yet, in 40 degree weather for a lot of these games, there's a lot going on, is my point. And I think the Masters certainly dominated the weekend. Let's start there. You've been tracking this PGA stuff and the LIV stuff actually for a bunch of years now. And you were as early with somebody on Scottie Scheffler as I think anybody could be, because you've been running these names into our system now manually for a bunch of years, and his name just keeps popping up at the top of your list, and it's just hard to look away at this point. So, you know, he's not selling t-shirts, right? I mean, he's not that guy, but he's winning golf tournaments and he's winning the big ones, and certainly this weekend winning them with ease. What are the numbers on Scottie Scheffler now running into mid-April of 2024 for his career?
Yeah, we're talking about $82 million in total career earnings. So on SpotTrack.com, we split off earnings official versus unofficial versus, the PIP stuff. That's like
match play and all that stuff, right? We kind of split those things off, yeah.
Yeah, and then some of the bonuses, Comcast Business Top 10, the PIP stuff, the championship bonuses at the end of the year. So we've sort of split everything out. So what I'm talking about is total. I mean, he's jumped up quite a bit. $82 million.
Change, yeah.
Sixth all time in history right now. So the last few years of influx of cash that they've been putting into these enhanced events, the final bonuses that they've been pushing more money in, it's just increasing these salaries, tenfold compared to what they've been in the past. I mean, we have a spot on the PGA section where it's earnings champions by year. And if you go and take a look, you can see the difference. And right now, Scottie Scheffler, before the Masters, was at $11.5 million. Now add in $3.6 million. Mm-hmm. So that jumps him up to 15. Last season he was at 21, And then the prior season, he was the highest at 14, and then we're in sevens, nines, eights. So the influx of cash has really helped the ones that win. It's jumping them up the rankings quite quickly right now.
2 points on this quickly. He's 27 years old, Scott, and he's sixth all-time in earnings. And you're right. It's a good point to make that a lot of this, or at least part of this, is that LIV Golf kind of shook up the PGA world and somewhat doubled these purses in a lot of instances, right? So recency bias a little bit there with some of the money he's earned, except, and correct me if I'm wrong, Scottie Scheffler's not won a tour championship. Is that correct?
I do not think
he doesn't have that like massive bonus at the end. Yeah, he doesn't have that $18 million Rory McIlroy bonus that, you know, that is sitting on his 100 and change earnings. Yeah, so highest, this is just grinding it out, winning small tournaments, winning majors. Yeah.
Yeah, the highest tour championship bonus that he's had was $5.57 million in 2022. Last year it was $2 million. He's at a $2.5 million. So he's at the top, but not, you know, maxing out on that. The other thing that I'll say is with, you know, the recency biases, we have a spot by date range. So you can go in and say, how have players, golfers performed over a certain amount of period? If I rewind it all the way to April 2001 of last year through today, which I haven't gotten the Masters in yet, I'm efforting to get those in right now. When the Masters is in there, he's going to be upwards of $24 million in the last year. The next closest is Wyndham Clark at $16.7 million, and then it drops to Victor Hovland at $11.3 million. So he's just been crushing everything that he's been doing. He's made every cut that he's had. So he just keeps climbing up the leaderboard as far, no pun intended, of the, you know, the career earnings and official earnings and everything else. He's just in that prime spot right now. The other thing that I will mention is this was his 120th event that he's had in the PGA, which if you go and look at the career earnings, we're dealing with, you know, a comparison of, you know, Tiger Woods has 378, Phil Mickelson 663, Rory McIlroy 245. You know, all these guys at the top of the leaderboard have triple the amount of events that Scotty has had. So if he continues this trajectory, in addition to the amount of events that he can eventually get to, he may crush Tiger at the top at 120.9 million.
I mean, 100 million this year is in reach. If he wins the tour championship this year, he can amass 100 million this year, Scott.
Yes.
That's how far ahead he is at his age. And where golf is financially speaking versus where it was when Tiger was in his heyday and, you know, way back when Rory McIlroy was winning tournaments. So
yeah, let me reiterate that the 120 million I said was official on course. Tiger official Woods tournaments overall is 157.4 million, but he only has had 150,000 in tour championship bonus because that only kicked in 2019. This player impact program that they have didn't kick in until 2021. Comcast Business Tour top 10, that's 2021. So some of these things, like I said, are an influx of cash that have come in recently that some of the older players haven't. But still, Scotty's on a tear right now.
Yeah. All incentives aside, he's just flat out winning. And, you know, in this league, in any league, that's going to be buco bucks. The LIV stuff, just quickly. You know, it was a decent showing from the LIV players in this Masters. We haven't talked in a while about this because nobody's talked in a while about this because there's nothing to talk about with this. Where are we headed? Is this just going to be life for a while? You think everybody's sort of settled into this a little bit, that there's just two leagues, different in nature, different in everything, right? Money, different in how many holes there are and what days a week and what channel they're on and the streaming, you know, all of it's completely apples and oranges, but for, you know, four days, four times a year, it's kind of looked like it always did, right?
Yeah. And from our analytics, as I was looking over the weekend, I mean, everyone was jumping to look at LIV Golf earnings as opposed to during their regular season that they have, there's you know, the far and few between. But as soon as the Masters hits, everyone wants to take a look and compare and see how they're doing in the LIV Golf. So it gives us a nice bump there. But as far as where is this going, I wouldn't be surprised if, similar to how everything else went down when this dropped, it just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah,
it's probably going to be on a Friday afternoon and we're going to get some information and it's going to drop and we're all going to be like, holy cow, what is going on? Similar to how the whole deal went down to begin with. It just came out of nowhere. But for right now, it is what it is. And, you know, without any more information than that, we're sort of stuck with PGA Tour running with what they are, LIV running on their own TV network that it's, you know, you got to go find. And like you said, different hole numbers, there's teams, there's team bonuses, all that jazz.
Okay. What's next? What's next for this whole golf scene? I mean, because this is kind of the big crescendo, which is funny because it's April and people that really follow this sport know this thing runs till Thanksgiving hard. it's an arduous schedule, right? And then if you include match play and if there's a Ryder Cup to deal with and the Olympics, right? There's a hell of a lot going on here for these golfers. Are we going to see somebody like Scottie Scheffler start to dial it back a little bit, Scott? You know, it seems like he's at a pretty good clip here, and we all know it's famous now. He's about to be a father, right? And you and I know what that's like with work life. Do you foresee him dialing things back a little bit? Or is somebody in his ear right now saying, look, you are on a Tiger run? And I don't even think that's hyperbole, right? I mean, this is a Tiger run for, I think, the better part of 3 years now. You just got to ride this thing out until you're not hot anymore. Is that maybe the best advice you can give Scottie Scheffler here?
Yeah, he's the face of the PGA right now, for sure. So I think you have to ride it. The schedule has changed where the points, it's based off of the calendar year now. So in January is when things really ramp up and they're, you know, the golfers do golf in the fall, but it's not being applied to the current FedEx, you know, points. So, you know, he can take off the winter if he wants. He can still play in the winter, fall if he chooses to, but we're pretty much, you know, they're with these increased purses, they're trying to push the players to go to those certain events and they have an obligation to, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but they have to make a certain amount of those enhanced part of theirs. They can only, I think, miss one, maybe two of those events. I know Rory missed at the beginning of the season. He missed one of the enhanced events, but pretty much if you're a part of the, you know, the cream of the crop, you have to say you're going to be at these enhanced events. So
no more than ever. I mean, you came out swinging with the right statement. The PGA Tour needs Scottie Scheffler.
Yeah. 100%. You know? Yeah, 100%. He's the face, and he needs to be the face. So they need him as much as possible.
Yeah, how many times are we going to try to run Jordan Spieth and Rory McIlroy cameos? You know, and they're just going to be continually letting us down. I mean, I know Rory had a halfway decent run 2 years ago, of course, but it just feels like he's the only one holding the candle to this thing right now. And by the way, you're right about the adjusted schedule, and this is pretty smart stuff. They're going to finish this thing September 1st in East Lake this year. So
right before the NFL really gets off,
brother. You know how everybody's thinking. Let's just get the heck out of the way of that freight train about to come through. Yep. All right, let's flip over to the NBA here. Kind of your bread and butter for everything Spot Track. In fact, you're doing the NBA Next podcast with Keith Smith. That's probably what, two or three times a week these days with off season stuff pretty much upon us, right? Twice.
Yeah, once a week right now, but we're going to start dialing it up to two because we're diving into all of the off season previews. Yeah. Keith's been working on.
Yeah, and I was going to start there. There's already three live on SpotTrack.com. They're deep dives into, it's reverse chronological order, right? So the worst teams first, that'd be Detroit and San Antonio and Washington, for those of you not playing at home. You know, draft capital, trade exceptions, all the entities of free agency and tax stuff and everything absolutely nerdy about the formulaic world that is the NBA finances that Keith eats, sleeps, and dreams about. And it's that time of year. I mean, I know that, you know, we have 20 teams now vying for postseason stardom, and we'll get to that in a second here, but There's a bunch of really bad teams. And by the way, really bad teams this year. And I'm going to talk about that in a second when we flip, look at these standings, Scott, that Keith has already gotten into. Just off the top, I know you've spoken to him about a couple of these, and I know you've done a lot of work on them as well. Are any of these teams in that quick recovery mode? I mean, we all want San Antonio to be because of Victor Wembanyama. But I don't know. I mean, they had as many bads as goods this year. Let's put it that way. And it's going to take a hell of a quick recovery in free agency via the trade and with a draft that doesn't have much to offer. It's just not that kind of league, is it? Does it? Because in the NFL, the big discussion is seven teams swap places via playoffs or miss the playoffs every single year, right? It is that aggressive that you can change the course of a roster in an off season, right? So we're seeing Jacksonville and Indy and Tennessee and all these teams, Atlanta, aggressively change who they are, and they might win the division because of it. You know what I mean? Does that happen in the NBA? Can the Detroit Pistons do anything over the next 5 months to make them actual contenders in the Western Conference? Or is it just not that kind of league, Scott?
It's not that kind of league. This is a league where you progressively chip away and you don't go from last to first in this league. Now, the one team, and Keith and I just talked about this team on a recent episode, that can go potentially from third bottom in the West up to potentially, you know, the two or three seed next season is the Memphis Grizzlies, because they had so much injury, you know, injuries left and right, the jaw off the court stuff, but they have been a train wreck. Keith gave me a stat on Friday, which I think is now maybe up by one, but they've had, as of Friday when we recorded, they had 33 different players on the court this season. They've just been riddled with injuries. They've had guys on 10-day hardships that allows them to add guys to 10-day contracts over the max
streets. Yeah.
And it's been a revolving door of these hardships because they have so many guys injured. So that is a team, when if they can all come back healthy next season, they're a one that can jump from the bottom to the top. Okay. But like you said, San Antonio, they got a lot of work to do. Portland, they got a lot of work to do. They had a lot of injuries as well. In the East, Detroit, they can make some moves. They're going to have cap space, but it's going to be have to be a calculated move, and it may just get them up into the play-in tournament, sort of like what Houston did this year. Yeah. They probably, out of all the teams, had the biggest jump as far as going from the bottom up, almost making it into the play-in tournament. Kind of fell short down towards the, you know, the backstretch towards the playoffs here. But they made huge strides, but they made a lot of, you know, they brought in Dylan Brooks, they brought in Fred VanVleet. So they made a lot of signings and made some moves to try to put around their young core, because they already had their young core. So, you know, they may make another move this offseason to try to get them up a little bit higher. But like you said, this is not a league where you go from worst to first. It's a league where you try to move up four or five spots in a standing, you try to move up four or five spots in a standing the next year, and you're just sort of chipping away until you feel that it's your year, and then you sort of push the chips in.
I can't disagree. It's the kind of thing where you draft a guy 1 year, then you hope you draft another guy the next year, then you hope you hit the right free agent the next year, and then maybe you have a 40-win team, right? I mean, it does feel like a marathon. There are a few teams, though, that we can focus on for the next couple of months here. Well, I'll give you one of each. Oklahoma City is one of these teams, right? I mean, maybe the greatest example in the history of the NBA of just how long it sometimes takes to get to this point. Is OKC being the one seed in the West the most surprising thing that we have for us over the next couple of weeks? Or is it somebody that's lower? Is it that the Knicks are a two seed? You know, what is the most surprising result of the 20 teams that we have now in this playoff format?
I mean,
I don't think. Go ahead.
I think Minnesota being at three may surprise a lot of people after the train wreck of what they had last season.
That's fair.
But knowing it, Anthony Edwards and his trajectory and things working out, again, the Clippers, we sort of expect them to be there. But again, they've been riddled with injuries. And
yeah,
we, at the beginning of the season, we were saying, what Paul George are we going to get? What Kawhi Leonard are we going to get? And they showed up. And so they're in the fourth seed. I was hoping Orlando was going to, you know,
hit the
be
two.
A little bit higher than the fifth seed, because I think that is the team that sort of overachieved for what most people thought they were. I think they're, you know, they were probably that one season away from really making a move. I was hoping they were going to really make a move at the trade deadline, and they really didn't. So maybe this offseason is when they decide, all right, we're going to push all of our chips in. Going back to the Oklahoma City Thunder, I think they were okay doing what they did because Chet was sort of like that, you know, signing that he didn't play at all last year. He got to learn for a whole year, and then he comes back, and it's sort of like that, you know, that signing that you didn't have to do, but because you already had it in your back pocket. So I was talking to Keith earlier today, and I said, if I remember correctly, I think I said at the beginning of the season, I was saying Oklahoma City is the team that most people are going to say that they're 1 year away. And I think that's the team that they're going to be at the top of the West. So I was high on them going into the season, and I thought they were going to make a bigger move at the trade deadline than Gordon Hayward. They didn't make that move, but they didn't have to make the move. So if they can go make a deep run and get potentially to the championship round, you know, that just sets them up to, you know, maybe make a splash or a move if they need to this coming off season.
I think the teams you're mentioning in this little segment here are all belong in this conversation. And I'd look at it this way. Isn't Orlando just following the coattails of Oklahoma City at this point in time? Yeah. Right. OKC didn't make that big swing. Orlando's not ready to make that big swing yet. OKC was a 10 seed, a play-in team last year. They didn't move the needle at all. Right. Now they're the one seed. Now there's some expectations. Now the Magic can kind of sit in their wings and see what happens to OKC. And if they can get to the finish line, and the reason I'm saying it this way is, you know, young teams don't do this. They don't beat the older teams, the veteran teams, when it comes to this time of year, because A, they're usually burned out, right? Because they're three times whatever college or academy season that they've already played, right? The season's so much longer than anything else they've ever done. And B, it's just a different type of game. It's not quite the NHL, right? The regular season versus the postseason in the NHL, which is literally man versus boys, right? But it's some of that. There's a hell of a lot more physicality. There's a hell of a lot more durability and stamina to this point of the season. I think Orlando just wants to see how OKC gets this done. And when they don't, they're going to be aggressive as heck this offseason, right? I mean, they have trade chips. They have probably one of these draft picks they can move easily. And I think they're a destination, maybe even more so than what OKC has been over the past couple of offseasons. So those two teams, I think, deservedly should be joined at the hip here to some degree, even though I think OKC is easier the class of the class. I'm going to give you my biggest surprise quickly, and then you can roll off it if you want.
Okay.
I'm stunned that the Phoenix Suns are a 49-win team in the sixth seed and probably don't belong in the sixth seed. They looked that bad down the stretch. They were built to stagger the injuries because the injuries were inevitable on this team. But they were built to withstand them, sort of like the Clippers were. I feel so much better about the Clippers in the four seed than I do Phoenix in the six seed. And I can't believe I'm saying that because the Clippers were the butt of all of my jokes to start the season in October, or at least when the Harden stuff all came to fruition. I don't know that I feel worse about a team in the postseason right now, not the play-in teams. I don't think I feel worse about a team than I do about the Phoenix Suns right now. And that's shocking because I am so much pro Booker, so much pro Durant. I'm just not there with this roster. And I'm kind of looking for you to poke some holes in that, I guess.
No, I agree with that because they have to go up against Minnesota and Phoenix doesn't really have a big. So when you've got Towns coming back, you've got Gobert, you got Anthony Edwards, who is a superstar. you know, Minnesota should roll over Phoenix. Yeah, they have Booker, they have Durant, but Beal's been a shell of himself, and the rest of the roster, they're strapped because they have such high salaries. They can only sign minimums, and then they had to make some trades at the trade deadline to try to help bolster that roster. But I think Minnesota rolls over them.
Okay, let's bring some money into this conversation because that's what we do for a living.
Before we go there, a great stat going back to the Oklahoma City Thunder. You mentioned that they've been a train wreck for a lot, you know, up until the point. They really haven't. Ever since they became the Oklahoma City Thunder, the first season they were in Oklahoma City, they had a losing record. Ever since then, they've had a winning record except for two seasons, the 2020-21 season and the 21-22 season. Every other season, they've had a winning record. So they just had two down years, and they just keep the train rolling. They have all those picks.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see how they operate. Keith and I talk about this team quite a bit because they own so many picks across the league that they can really do anything they want. They can make a trade. They can bring in a superstar. They can just roll with what they have. And because they own so many picks, these super tax teams, second apron teams, they're so strapped now with what they can do from an operating standpoint that the Thunder, they could essentially say, all right, give us, you know, $3 million for our second round pick. And if it's the, you know, the 25th pick, they'll take $3 million, or they'll just swap that first and kick it down the road and say, all right, we'll give you our 25 first round pick for your 30 first round pick. And then they know they're restocked in, you know, 5 years from now. So they really can do a lot. And I won't be surprised if you mentioned Orlando. I won't be surprised if they do a similar situation because they do. They have a mix of veteran players with young kids that they've drafted. Remember, SGA, they didn't draft SGA. They made that massive trade.
Paul George, baby.
Paul George to the Clippers. And that's where they've got a lot of these first round picks from. So I just wanted to bring up that point because they've been winning even with, you know, after the Harden, Westbrook, Durant years.
Yeah. It ties into where I was headed anyway, which is, you know, you've already started to run the numbers on 2024. There's some projections out there from Keith in terms of like spending power and cap stuff. And certainly with the aprons, because that's going to be a big talking point here now as this new CBA really starts to take form. I know Boston's ugly. I know Denver's ugly. I know Golden State's still ugly right now, even with Klay falling off of things. Those are the teams you're talking about here, right? Those are the teams that a team like an Orlando or OKC can bail out to a certain degree with, we'll buy you now. We'll take your money now to move some of the assets down the road so that you can free up a little bit of room, because a little bit goes a long way with these aprons, right? When we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars at some point. That's the kind of power OKC has right now. And they've got a GM that knows exactly what the hell he's doing, even though he's made his share of mistakes, of course. But
And Denver
the interesting part, Scott, is that you're talking about the best teams in basketball because they are pot committed to a certain degree. They're going to have to give a little bit at some point.
Yeah, and Denver started this last offseason where they started buying draft picks and second rounders.
They knew
they were going to get expensive real quickly because they had to pay guys, and then the new CBA kicked in, and they ended up buying two or three second round picks because they're cheap. They can, with the new second round exception, they can sign those guys using that exception because they're over a certain amount. And so you're going to start seeing more of that when we get around draft time and into the new league year. You're going to start seeing some of these second apron teams have to operate in a different manner than regular tax or just cap teams.
Okay. Speaking of tax teams, I have the 2023-2024 luxury tax numbers in front of me, at least as they stand right now. I know you'll finalize those once things come to us, but based on our numbers, how far do I have to go down the list 1 through 30 before I don't get to a playoff/play-in team? So I've got all 20 noted here in terms of even the play-in teams, because quite frankly, the number one team, Golden State, is a 10 seed right now. So I wouldn't have gotten very far with this bit if I didn't include the play-in teams. How far down the list do I have to go?
Yeah, you're at 13, Portland.
13. 13. That's pretty good. All right. That's about half the league. And then from there, it's not until 18 at Toronto.
Yep.
All right.
It's a pay to play league. We've talked about that.
That was exactly the sentence I was going to give you. We say it every year, even with the expanded playoffs, even with the tax stuff, even with all the rule changes in the CBA, it appears to still be a pay to play league. Obviously, we have to see how things shake out here, and OKC being a one seed with the 17th tax payroll is certainly a step in the right direction, right? That looks like Major League Baseball to me right there. That's what it looks like. That seems like a Tampa Bay Rays type ordeal. So if they go and win this thing, that's going to be the new conversation for us. Now, is that the trend? Is this something that can be done? Do you just have to forfeit basically 4 or 5 years of really playoff contention to kind of reset your clock and be intelligent with how you handle draft picks and things like that? But the Knicks, you know, are 12th at a two seed, even though they kind of limped into that two seed. There's a lot of good here. There's a lot of 11 through 17, right? That middle ground of tax allocations in the top four seeds in this postseason. I'm going to ask you this question right now. Did teams like Denver and Milwaukee and even the Clippers to some degree, did they take the gas pedal off on purpose here, Scott? Because there's a lot of ways to poke holes in what we're talking about here. And we're going to have a lot of tweets come at us over the next couple of days with, oh my God, Golden State barely made the play-in and there are $205 million pot committed. And how do you keep Steph Curry for the next 3 years? And you know where we're headed here. And the Lakers are in this conversation too. So I'm just trying to get all the kinks out with these conversations, right? And a lot of it's injury-based with Embiid and Giannis and certainly the Phoenix stuff that we talked about. But, you know, it's a big deal that Indiana's healthily in and OKC's healthily in. And even Cleveland to some degree with a bunch of their, you know, they've had some Donovan Mitchell stuff and certainly some Evan Mobley stuff throughout the season. So just, I guess, overall, generally speaking, do you think the pay-to-play stuff is at least transitioning a little bit here? And that some of the teams that are at the top here that are hamstrung by some of these CBA rules, A, do you think it's affecting them? B, do you think they've just forced themselves to not go, you know what to the wall for 82 games because it's just the better approach for June and for May?
Yeah, it is a better approach for just to get into the playoffs and see what happens. But yeah. I think what we're seeing is, some of these teams they're older.
Yeah. The
Suns, they're an older team. The Clippers, they're an older team. Golden State Warriors, they're an older Lakers. Team. The Lakers, Milwaukee, you know, they're even an older team with, you know, Lillard, Middleton. So Denver, they're getting there, but I'm not going to say that they're the oldest. Some of these other teams are even older. We're just seeing new blood and teams are getting smarter with how they're paying overall.
Bingo.
And it's only going to get worse as the seasons go on because the max just continues to go up because the cap goes up. So I think as these salaries do get larger, we may see teams get even more, efficient with what they offer. As these players get older, we may not see the 4 year maxes for an older player. It may be, all right, we'll give you a 1 and 1 just to see. Or they may get creative like a Chris Paul where, all right, we'll pay you guaranteed over 2.5 seasons and then we'll make non-guaranteed in the back end. Teams are getting smarter with it, especially now that these rules are in place. Now, keep in mind, some of these rules are, came in when they already had a lot of these salaries on the
board.
So, like Golden State already had those salaries. LA Clippers, they had them. They added the extension with Kawhi during the season, but he took sort of a haircut. But, it's still a lot of money to have to be on there. Phoenix Suns, they paid the supermax for Booker before these new rules came in, and then they made the trade for Durant. And so some of these teams sort of just have to maybe just wait it out, see where things go. They're going to be hamstringed for a while. But some of these teams at the bottom, Oklahoma City, You know, they're going to get expensive. Memphis is going to get expensive quickly because they've drafted well, and then they're going to have to pay them. So I guess the easy answer is the teams have to just operate how they see fit. And let me go to Minnesota. Minnesota, the sale fell through per rumors because Lori and Rodriguez were going to completely cut the roster, where Glenn Taylor doesn't want that because they're having an all-time high season right now for them. They've got a chance at a championship, and he didn't like the trajectory of where things were going to go. And that's a team that is going to get wildly expensive. Keith did a great piece on Minnesota a couple months ago, breaking down everything and sort of did foresight on where this was going. That's a team that's going to be in the top five of tax very quickly.
Yeah.
So it's just,
and OKC's coming. Yeah, you're right.
Come, because you're going to have to pay Chet. You're going to have to pay, at some point, SGA again. Mm-hmm. And the team just has to operate how they see fit. And you're seeing that in Boston. They paid Brown. They're going to have to pay Tatum. Keith and I talked about this Friday, that he is extension eligible on July 1, and he said it's going to happen. He's already he's already triggered that he can get the Supermax. Just rip the Band-Aid off, pay him now. They did the Holiday extension. They already did Porzingis. Yeah. Derek White is going to be on there too. So they're sort of in this window of push the chips in right now, because A, the new media deal hasn't come through yet, so we don't know what kind of influx of money is going to happen. The expansion is coming quickly. The cap itself, we don't necessarily know what that cap number is going to be. So if we're projecting a $56 million salary right now based off of projections, that may be 65 by the time we actually get to it, because the salary cap may go up. So teams are, I think, more so operating in the now than looking out 5 years, because they really don't know where that cap maximum and the luxury tax threshold, they don't know where those are going to be because of the unknowns.
Everything you're saying, I think, is correct. And it leads me to, I think, one final point, which probably doesn't have an answer right now. But if anybody's going to have at least a projection, it'll be you and Keith. And I'm sure you've talked about this ad nauseum. But just to give me one or two sentences on it here, sort of as a primer to where things may be headed. Because you're right. There's a strong group of extension eligible players, right? A bunch of these superstar players that are going to be at the forefront of these NBA playoffs over the next couple of weeks are going to be paid handsomely. But you're right. The cap is going to continue to rise. The tax threshold is going to continue to rise. It's a formulaic league, right? So everybody kind of trickles up together. But that doesn't mean everybody, right? It doesn't. It doesn't mean, in fact, it's going to start meaning less and less people trickle up. And is that the point to be made here? And how is that going to impact these super teams? Because they do still exist. Minnesota is a super team. Not because they did it via free agency, but because they did it via all channels, right? Denver sort of drafted a super team somehow, which is ridiculous in this day and age. Boston, to some degree, is now a combination of everything. But the best teams in basketball are already stockpiled. And every one of them, right? Jamal Murray in Denver, Jason Tatum in Boston, every team has somebody that's going to need $55 to $60 million a year, because that's just the going rate now for this Supermax extension, right? And that's only going to get more expensive. Is it going to be sustainable? I can't get away from this question, Scott. I can't, because I live in the NFL quarterback world, like 23 out of 24 hours a day. It's the question I get asked the most. Well, how can a team win if their quarterback makes $55 million, et cetera, et cetera? Is there a team that is just different, right? If Mahomes is the difference, the unicorn for all of this, and Brady was this for 20 years in a very minuscule look at the salary cap, but in this heavy salary cap situation that Mahomes is in, if he is the A and everybody else is just way underneath him. And they're dealing with their own problems because their quarterback doesn't have the ability to rise up and to do what Mahomes can do. Is Jokic that player? Like, is Denver going to get away with this because he is that singular? He is that unicorn. And if you're just paying him, it's like having three contracts on your books. And is nobody else in the league going to be able to do this? Right? The Celtics might be able to do what you're saying for 3 years, and then it's going to have to come crashing. And Jason Tatum's going to be 30 years old when that happens. You know what I mean? Like, he's not going to be 35. He's not going to be done, but Boston's not going to be able to hold this for 5 years. There's no chance with the current way the CBA looks. So how is this going to look? Is this going to feel like the NFL in a couple of years where the money's crazy, but not everybody's getting that money? And in fact, 3/5 of starting lineups are still in the teens, and Luka Doncic is making 70, because that's coming. I know that's coming around the corner. So where are we getting to here? You know, is this a healthy state for the league?
So rewind back to May of last year. Keith and I had a great discussion on our pod about the max salaries, and we projected them out. And, you know, if we project out to 2028, and you're getting 35% of the cap, your starting salary is $72 million. And I know what you're saying. Yeah. The difference between the NFL and the NBA is it is formulaic. So as the cap goes up, the percentage is going to continue to just make the dollars look larger, but the percent is still the percent. So there's a reason why on the multi-year view, you see a percent with the value now, because we're going to get to a point where we just have to reference players at their percent. And Keith and I were talking about this on Friday as well, because he brought up, he posed a question to me of, is Victor Wembanyama going to be the first NBA player to exceed $1 billion in career earning salary? I thought it was a fantastic question. We went back and forth, but because the cap is going to continue to go up, we have to look at it as a percent, because we have a 25%, a 30%, a 35% of the salaries. That no matter what the cap is, those players are going to get those percents. The mid-levels, those are a percent based off of the cap. The rookie scale is a percentage of the cap. The minimums is a percent. Everything is based off of the percentage of the cap going up. So no matter what the salaries are, the middle tier is still going to get a bump. The minimums are going to get a bump at the same rate as these other ones. The other 35, 30%, those just are gaudy looking because they're already gaudy looking, and it's just going to continue. But like in the NFL, that minimum salary is pretty much locked in for the entire CBA. Same with Major League Baseball. It's already locked in. So yeah, as those caps and thresholds go up, that percentage of those minimums continues to stay. It gets watered down more and more every year. Whereas in the NBA, it's not going to be the case. So as we're talking about those guys at the top, is it going to be, you know, hamstrung for those teams to have those? I don't think so, because they're going to operate it at 35% no matter what. The dollar sign is just going to look worse, because we're going to be talking about someone who's making $85 million a year in 10 years or even more. But when you actually look at the percentage, oh, they're only 35% of that cap. So the teams are going to make it work because it's formulaic. Now, when the new CBA is up for the 2029 season, you know, maybe they have to readdress the max or readjust or reset the cap, because it's going to keep going up. I don't foresee that happening, but, you know, that's still 5 years out. But teams are going to operate as they have. Remember, 3-4 years ago, you and I were on and we were talking about, how are you going to trade Chris Paul or John Wall or Russell Westbrook and all these guys that were making $40 million, and they've been rotated through 4 or 5 different teams now. It's just the nature of the beast, and teams are going to deal with it. And if you're a Boston Celtics or you're a Denver Nuggets and you win a championship, and if, you know, if you're Boston and you just paid all these guys and you get 1 or 2 championships out of it, and you have to blow it up and trade one or two pieces in 5 years. I think Boston, from an organization standpoint, is okay with that because they got their championship. Denver got their championship. So they're sort of playing with house money right now. At some point, they may have to blow it up and move off and, you know, reset, because some of these owners, we're seeing it in Golden State. The owner finally came out and said, we can't sustain this tax very long, you know, much longer, because it's getting wildly expensive and it hurts your roster construction. So my long-winded answer is the teams are still going to operate as normal. It's not going to be like the NFL. The numbers are going to be the numbers. And because it's a percentage-based system now, they're just going to keep moving forward.
I'll disagree in one regard. You're absolutely right, right? And if I'm looking at Denver next year, Jokic, Murray, and Michael Porter Jr. account for 87% of their salary cap. And that's not going to change. This is not.
Yeah, but that is a completely jaded outlook from... Now, are you saying of the salary cap number or over their overall, their cap allocations? I don't have it looking in front of me.
Yeah, based on the percentages of what we're projecting for next year's salary cap, they're 86% of it. Okay. And there's a lot of moving parts there, but and it's not a hard cap. There's a lot of ifs here, right? But that is the modern day super team. That is three players on max contracts, right? Two at 25%, one at 30%. And that's just where we are. And you're right. That probably doesn't change. Except for this. Let's fast forward to, I don't know, 2-3 years here when 70 is the number. Because that's coming. You know that's coming. Mm-hmm. There has to be a decrease in max contracts. Has to be. There has to be a new threshold for who is worthy of a max contract. Right? Because there are a lot of names right now, Scott, that are unbelievably debatable, right? And I'm not even sure that it gets enough debate, because teams just say, I have to max this guy or he's going to walk, because there are four other teams out there that will do it. I think what will happen, Scott, is teams will refuse it and there may be more player movement. There may be more good players traded before extended, right? Like, let's say Jason Tatum in 4 years after this next extension starts to get long in the tooth is 30 years old. Boston's already won two championships. That's a player that probably gets traded 5 years before he would have been traded 5 years ago, if you understand what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a point in time where teams just decide we can't do it. Whereas right now, everybody even close, including Ben Simmons, right? I mean, if you want to give the worst example humanly possible, including Ben Simmons, just gets the max contract to reduce the negotiation, to reduce any noise from other teams coming in saying, we'll do it. We'll definitely do it. Just give us a chance. Let's work out a trade. They're just doing it. That's got to stop. To me, that's going to at least thin out. So that'll improve things. I think it'll improve things, and it maybe even make for even more parity in this league. Not that it needs it, in my opinion.
Yeah, potentially. The NBA is a pay for what you can do in our future, not necessarily we're going to pay you for what you've already done. So like point guards usually takes 6 to 7 years, 6 to 8 years for a point guard to truly understand the game. So that's right. Why, you know, their teams are okay in paying if you see a point guard that has the potential, you're going to pay them because you're hoping that they continue to make that trajectory. Mm-hmm. And as they get more wise in their, you know, second contract. But I do see what you're saying. Teams, they're already getting smarter. Keith has a hard time coming up with worth valued contracts because the teams just, you know, they're smarter with their money for the most part. That, I mean, dealing with the Bradley Beal situation in Washington, that probably shouldn't have even happened, but they did. They paid him. They passed him on. And that, you know, that's probably at the top of the list for sure. But teams are going to have to be smarter as the tax teams are in there, because you can't aggregate salaries with players for super, you know, the second apron teams. Mm-hmm. They They can't buy buyout players that are above the non-taxpayer mid-level. They can't send cash out anymore. Right. So they can't necessarily, if you're a second apron team, you can't go and say, I'm gonna pay you for a pick. So teams are
in other words, other teams can't bail those teams out anymore, which is a really nice is a really nice addition to the CBA.
It is. But as I prefaced earlier, teams are in a win now. If they see they can do, they're going to pay and they're going to push some chips in now. Mm-hmm. But in the
so do you disagree with me then? Do you disagree? Do you still think the fringe players just get maxed because they can just trade them in 2 years anyway?
Yeah, I do. Because what ends up happening is because you're going to see teams do in sort of an overpay, because if you can pay a player $20 million, but you're a second apron team, we'll pay you 25 to 28 because that gives you a little bit of a buffer to bring in a $25 million player in 3 years, as opposed to a $20 million player in 3 years. So there may be a little bit of overpay on some of the players that they have rights to, draft rights, anything like that. So there may be a little bit of that where they're inflating a number so that they can flip it on the backside and get a more solid player for that bang for their buck a year later. So there's going to definitely be some creativity, roster manipulation as far as inflating some salaries potentially, because they have to look 2 or 3 years ahead of time, even though they want to push the chips in now.
It's chestnut checkers. So Jalen Suggs, the number 5 pick in 2021, who's averaging 11 points a game and 3.5 rebounds a game, but is unbelievably valuable to this Orlando team, right? Defensively speaking. And just probably from a ceiling standpoint, right? Is he exactly what you're talking about? Is Jalen Suggs going to get a max contract from the Orlando Magic because of what you're saying?
Or close to max? Like Desmond Bane was a quote unquote max player, but he didn't get the true total max because of incentives or how it worked out. The incentives make it look like it's a max. So that is a great example with Memphis not necessarily having to pay the max, but they make it look like the max. Suggs could be in the same situation. A couple other players may be in the same situation. We'll pay you because we want you, but if for some reason in 2 to 3 years we need to put you for an upgrade, then we already have high salaries for flipping.
It's a freaking wild league, man. It feels like the wild, wild west, I think, to the average outsider from, the minutiae, the actual numbers, facts, and figures. But there is no league in sports more formulaic. There just isn't. Every trade has a purpose, right? That's why four teams have to get involved, because there has to be A plus B plus C equals X at times, right? That's how Chris Paul got traded. That's how all these unbelievable, terrible contracts get moved. Every rookie scale is slotted and has exponential increases based on the thresholds that are built around the max contracts. Everything about this league is in sync. And I think it's one of the reasons, maybe the singular reason, that this thing has prospered so much. Now, there's international, there's a lot, there's talent, there's smaller rosters, there's a lot to it. But just having a formula in place for almost everything, right? And having smart people like Keith who can, I think, kind of push this thing forward even more, right? I mean, with the help of social media and actually call out some mistakes that are made and make people smarter in this regard, this entire league feels like it's running on a Tesla engine right now. You know what I mean? And it just gets upgraded every year. Every CBA, we see more and more things that feel ahead of every other league. You know, like the NFL salary cap is so Stone Age, right? It's so Stone Age to the point, that you can manipulate it so much that it feels fake. It's not fake, but there is nothing fake about what the NBA has constructed, Scott. Do you agree with that? I mean, especially with this latest tax stuff. And Keith, who is not a very animated guy when it comes to, you know, the negative side of things, he was, his reaction to some of the second apron stuff and some of the slaps on the wrist that some of these teams will take got me thinking, oh, I should take this seriously because there's going to be some blowback. And I guess that's where I was trying to go here. Is it going to actually change the roster construction process? And I think we've landed on no, at least for now. Is that how you want to finish this? No.
The talking about the tax stuff?
Just everything. Just the current iteration of finances for the next few years in the NBA. I don't think a lot is going to change based on our talk here.
I think teams have to have more foresight. You know, the spending is going to happen. You get those superstars, you're gonna pay them because, like you said, it is formulaic. In the Minnesota piece that we did, Keith and I worked together, and I helped figure out what the tax bills would be if Anthony Edwards got the max or got the super max. If they're, you know, if certain players were signed, because it's formulaic, we can project what the Minnesota Timberwolves tax bill would be next season or the year after or whatever it might be, because we can sort of project those contracts out and see what the bill is going to be. We know what the minimum salaries are going to be. We know what the rookie scales. I mean, teams are probably slotting, all right, we know based on our team right now, we are probably in the 20 to 25 range of the draft for the next 3 years. So based on the formula and the projected cap, I know what the 20th to the 25th picks are going to be from a monetary standpoint for the next 4 years. Then they can slot that in and say, all right, our tax is going to be this amount of money if we have these players on our roster still, because we like our roster. So they can really do nerdy spreadsheet kind of stuff and project what is our outlook going to be, which is probably what Mark Laurie and Alex Rodriguez did. They probably did some internal projections of that kind of stuff, knowing who they already have and Anthony Edwards and where they may be. And they saw that it was going to be extremely expensive, even 5-10 years out. And they don't want to necessarily have to pay deep into the tax. So it is going to, from a roster construction standpoint, it may not, on the surface level, do a lot, because like I said, teams are still going to pay if they have to win a championship. It's just going to be the second apron teams. They have to think differently than an Orlando Magic or a San Antonio Spurs or Detroit Pistons right now, because they have different handcuffs on them than those bottom teams.
All right, man. Good stuff. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yep. Have a good one.